Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. A little later on in the podcast, you'll hear our Deputy Editor Caroline's interview with Bart and Marnix, who are the creative directors of the Dutch design studio Vrijpak, which was founded in 1961. And has a portfolio, check this out, of more than 7,400 designs. Incredible. What I love about Bart and Marnix is the way they approach superyacht design. They take a really novel look at everything they do and the fact they're fully dialed in to the issue of superyacht sustainability. So please do stick around for that. It's a really, really good interview. A few quick housekeeping notes before we move on. The Dock Walk salary survey is closing soon. We've had a great response so far, but there's still a little time to contribute and make sure this is the most accurate guide available for crew salaries. And it really is a great benefit to the whole crew industry, and we'll talk about crew in a bit more depth in a sec. So head to dockwalk.com now if you are working on a superyacht currently or have worked on a superyacht, and you can find out more about the salary survey and enter some details to help make that a really, really comprehensive guide. Also, tickets for the World Superyacht Awards are on sale now. The big event is happening on the 5th of September in Monaco. The nominees for the awards can be seen now on Boat International's website. And this is the real marquee event. These are the Oscars, the one everyone wants to win. So check all the nominees out now. And you can also find info about ticket prices and how to buy them on the website, as well as some nice kind of backstory and insidery information about how the World Superyacht Awards was created, what it means to people, and how it's developed over the years. So I personally cannot wait for that date in Monaco. It's going to be fantastic.
It's always lovely seeing people celebrating at those awards. I know that people were doing it remotely last year, and it was great to see that there was still the same level of enthusiasm. I'm sure in person people will be even more excited when they're winning stuff.
I love it when you see an owner get on stage who is quite circumspect in the crowd, or sometimes maybe a bit attention shy or publicity shy, but they get on stage with the award and hold it aloft like they've just won the World Cup with a huge smile on their face. That's always a really, really great moment. Look, it's worth saying again, these really matter because of who the judges are. They're all superyacht owners with hundreds of years of boat-only experience between them. They really know what they're looking for and talking about. So to win one of these kind of peer-judged awards matters. So have a look now at the website. You can see there's some brilliant nominees this year. Judging has been done, and so we'll be revealing who won what in Monaco on the 5th of September. Right. That's the housekeeping done with. Charlotte, you've been looking, as mentioned, into crew.
I have. I've been all about the crew these days.
Tell us more.
Sure. So I've been working on our big crew special this week. It's something that we do every year, and it's going to run in our October issue, along with some really beautiful cartoons that are being worked on now. But the idea is that this is your sort of complete 101 guide that tells you everything you need to know about crew. So from how much you should be paying them, to how you should be hiring a really great crew and keeping them on board, how many hours it's fair to expect them to work. I know that that's a particularly kind of hot topic right now. So it's a very big guide. But I thought for the podcast listeners, I would just pull out a few of the kind of top tips that came out, especially when it came to looking if you're sort of trying to hire people. I know it's a lot of chopping and changing in the industry at the moment because of COVID, people moving, people leaving boats, people buying and selling boats. So here's a few tips from the experts if you're going through that process now. This first one made me laugh. One, a very experienced crew manager told me, she said if she's ever interviewing a captain who says they've never had any issues with crew, that's just a massive lie. Don't believe them. It's a big red flag. Any decent captain has come across their fair share of crew difficulties. And if they're good, they'll tell you that, and they'll tell you how they worked through it and what happened. If they say they've never had any issues, that's a bit of a red flag.
I mean, anyone who's seen a single episode of Below Deck
I feel that the captains on Below Deck always seem particularly stressed out. I think they have a rougher ride than most. But yeah, it's something that people come up against. And sort of likewise, if people badmouth previous owners or yachts and really go to town kind of destroying their previous employers, that's not good to see. And another one I thought this was interesting, particularly because I know lots of owners are very savvy business people and they do drive a hard bargain. But lots of people I spoke to said, don't be tempted to try and sort of lowball crew with an initial cheeky first offer when you're hiring. Because essentially all of these guys are on big WhatsApp groups, Facebook groups. They talk to each other all the time. If you go in too low, they're going to tell everyone it's a crap job. Don't touch it with a barge pole. And before you know it, you're really struggling to hire someone. So the takeaway from that was kind of, if you meet someone you like, you click with, they're qualified, you think they're good, make them a good fair offer, pretty sharpish. Don't be tempted to try and, you know, go in low and work your way up, because very often that's something that backfires.
And look, it's worth saying, like, boats get a bad rep. I know I've spoken to many crew in the past who say they just wouldn't work on certain boats. They just have a kind of a bad smell about them. Either there's, you know, they've been bad captain or owner relationships or whatever it is. There's a vibe or a reputation around a boat. So that boat forever has an issue recruiting really, really top quality crew to it. And it's quite a hard reputation to rehabilitate. Often it takes it's considerable kind of personnel change quite often to kind of bring that back into the good books of many of the crew. So I completely understand that point, and it's really worth reinforcing.
And it was so obvious to me as well how easy it is to check out these references. You know, the boat world is actually so small when you look at it in terms of checking people out. And these crew agents and captains that have been in the industry for years, you know, if someone says they've worked somewhere, it's a matter of minutes to actually call up the boats, to call the people on the boats. There was a funny story that came out of one of them. A lady I was interviewing said, you know, she was once interviewing this guy. She was a chief mate on a boat. And he said, oh, I worked on this boat under this captain. And she said, oh, that is interesting. You know, I know him. How's he doing? And this candidate panicked and sort of said, oh, he's dead now, he's not around. And she was kind of shocked, only to find out obviously he wasn't dead at all. The guy was fibbing. He'd never worked with this bloke, but he just sort of put him on his CV. And it's very easy to dig deep, and you know, lying on CVs is pretty common, I'm told. It's not that rare. And the last one is, it's a bit of a no-brainer, but it's a good point nonetheless, which is just to try and make sure you give your crew time off for training. I know there's a lot of focus on kind of shore leave and rotation and that sort of thing, but lots of people I spoke to said they've left jobs simply because they wanted to upskill, they wanted to do a one-week course, they weren't allowed the week off, so the only option for them was to change posts. And it seems like a tragedy to me that if you've got good, motivated people that want to learn, that want to get better at their jobs, that they'll be leaving you just because they couldn't have this time off, when really they could be going off learning and then, you know, returning your investment in delivering even better skills and expertise on board. And the overriding point that came out of all of this is that I think it was a third of all costs on board are from sort of accidental damage. So if you've got a really great crew, it really pays off financially, because they're heading off problems before they start and they're looking after things properly. So it's worth that sort of initial outlay and making sure you get really good people who see it as a long-term career rather than a gap year.
Yeah, I think, again, you know, kind of adds to the feeling on board. If you've got a long-term crew and you allow crew the opportunity to progress and take the necessary courses to, get from the deck to the bridge or whatever it is, then you have to, it's a great thing to do, to offer them that opportunity. And they stick with the boat, they're super loyal. And again, you know, like, it speaks to the former point. If you've got a crew of long-standing who are prepared to give great references to your boat and other crew members, because it's really not hard. Like you said, these networks are everywhere. So it's not difficult to find someone on LinkedIn or Facebook and ping them a thing saying, I know you served on X, is it any good? And then, you know, if the answer coming back is yes, you're going to get a much better crew for your super yacht. And if you, that's a charter boat, that's going to translate into, you know, repeat bookings and income, etc. So look, I mean, it is a no-brainer, isn't it? Treat your crew right, and it'll pay off dividends in the end. Alrighty, there's lots been happening on the super yacht news front. Meanwhile, Charlotte, why don't you kick us off with this week's first story?
Sure. Polish yard Sunreef has added the larger 30.48-metre Sunreef 100 Eco to its range of electric catamarans, which also includes the 50 Eco, 60 Eco, 70 Eco and 80 Eco. Described as the essence of sustainable superyacht design, the all-electric model is fitted with 270kW electric engines, high-performance batteries and 242.5 square metres of solar panels, enabling it to generate up to 46kW of energy. Elsewhere, the yacht will feature responsibly sourced or recycled finishing materials, as well as an energy-saving air conditioning system. Accommodation will be for a total of 12 guests alongside a spa, gym, bar and office.
This is a really exciting boat, a proper big super yacht catamaran and all electric too. Sunreef, kind of out of nowhere in the last 5 or 6 years, have really stolen a march in the catamaran space. They've really taken it by storm. They've been around for quite a long time, Sunreef, but they've just they've kind of caught a really nice wave. And so it's great to see that resulting in some really, really future forward yacht design and technology.
Actually, if you want to read a bit more about catamarans, we've got a great piece coming up in our Life Under Sail supplement, which is basically talking about the rise of catamarans, why there haven't been more of them to date, or why the uptake hasn't been as much as you might expect, and pointing to quite a few really exciting new designs, very good looking catamarans, which haven't always been their strong point, as well as super comfortable and super spacious. So look out for that in September.
Yeah, so that's so the Life Under Sail supplement. So friends of the magazine will know that a couple of times a year we dedicate an entire supplement to the sailing world, and so that is back for 2021. It's being bagged with the September issue, so please do look out for that. There's some great features, one of which is the one Charlotte just referenced, because it is, even Espen. I interviewed Espen Oino last year, and he's designed some catamarans for silver yachts, which are being built in China currently. Big motor catamarans, and he, if anyone knows, Espen's going to know, because he is really tuned into the owner market, and he really thinks catamarans in the next couple of years will they'll just take up a much bigger share of the market. And we see in the global order book, actually, each year numbers are really small, but an increase from 6 to 10 in build or something like that represents quite a large percentage shift in the number of catamarans being built. So sometimes it sounds more impressive, the percentage figure sounds more impressive than the raw numbers, but it is creeping up, and I think we'll see more and more of them. And if more and more of them can be all electric, that's really fantastic too. So good on Sunreef for investing and developing that project. Meanwhile, over in Italy, Bonetti has announced the delivery of its 65.4-metre superyacht Triumph. She was designed by long-term collaborator Giorgio Cassetta, with naval architecture handled in-house. Greener Mingarella Design assisted with the interior alongside Bonetti's in-house style team. So that's Greener Mingarella. Tina Green, obviously, another Bonetti owner. All artwork on board is by British photographer David Yarrow. He does those beautiful kind of animal photos. You see them quite a lot on yachts. They're beautiful images. Eddie Jordan's a big fan of David Yarrow, actually. Spanning 6 decks, the yacht accommodates 12 people in 6 opulent cabins. The owner's apartment is on the upper deck, and it spans 130 square meters. Features, as you'd expect, sauna, gym, massage room and a spa pool. There's a 70 square meter beach club with a drop down platform, plus a touch and go helipad on the bow.
Sounds very exciting. I always love Giorgio Cassetta's boats. Interesting to see them.
Yeah, he does a great job, Giorgio. He does a really, really good job.
And the last story is something to watch out for later in the year, which is that construction on Heesen's 57-metre project Akira is due to begin later this year, and the yard has just announced that. The yacht, which was first revealed at the 2019 Monaco Yacht Show, will begin construction at Heesen's Oss shipyard in the autumn following the laying of the keel. The 56.7-metre four-deck yacht is the first model in Heesen's 5700 aluminium class and features exterior design by Frank Lautmann's Omega Architects and interiors by Harrison Eidsgaard. Extensive structural and decorative glass is a key focus of the exterior design and helps to enhance the indoor and outdoor connection. Frank Lautmann of Omega Architects says, "We added a touch of aggression by way of sharp angles. The overall effect is the look of a leaping animal." I'm very exciting to see that come to life. The Harrison Eidsgaard interior, meanwhile, has been described as a versatile canvas that can be personalised later in the process without affecting the construction programme and delivery date. So it'd be interesting to see who takes that on and what they do with it.
Yeah, cool looking boat this. Excited to see Akira underway, or very soon to be underway. She's going to be a great looking boat. Right, before we move on to the data story this month, just some news. Our data guru, Raphael, congratulations, Raphael. Him and his wife have just had a baby. So all our best to Raphael down there in the south of France. He is the backbone of all the data we do, really, at Boat International. He's a human computer, that man. Amazing.
I think he was actually emailing us through this week's data story from the delivery ward. So we cannot thank him enough for persisting with this. And yeah, huge congratulations to Raphael.
Yeah. Every time I think I know something about super yachts, Raphael completely eclipses my knowledge. He is a walking reference. Absolute legend. So congratulations, Rafa. And also our podcast producer, Grace, is not going to be here for a couple of weeks as well. So those reasons combined, we'll be taking a 2-week break from recording of this podcast, and we'll be back with you in a couple of weeks, I think in August. So I hope you don't miss us too much. But before you can even get that opportunity, let's talk about this week's data story. And it's a niche subject this week. We're talking about flag states. So a quick run through the basics. A yacht's flag demonstrates or shows the nation under whose laws that particular vessel is plying in international waters. This can be the country in which the owner lives, or more commonly in the superyacht world, an offshore ship registry in a country with laws suited to the complexities of yacht ownership and charter. So the flag you choose can have a direct bearing on things like privacy taxes, exposure to liability, and the vessel's success as a commercial entity. So the most popular flag is the US one, which accounts for around 12% of the total superyacht fleet afloat. So that's 12% of all superyachts carry the US flag. So why is that? Well, it's mainly because these boats are owned by Americans. We know the brokerage market at the moment is red hot, and we know Americans are buying an awful lot of those boats. They account for about half of the market. So American owners like to flag their boats with an American flag, except those very biggest boats, often registered offshore. Anyway, so aside from national loyalty, there are some practical benefits to the US flag, mainly because it's a lot easier for a US citizen to have a yacht registered in the US if they sell or charter her in US waters. So why don't the very biggest boats owned by US owners typically carry a US flag? Well, this is getting into the weeds a bit, so bear with me. So the US Coast Guard legislation does not differentiate between merchant vessels and commercial yachts, meaning most large yachts would fail to meet their seagoing motor vessel requirements, which apply SOLAS requirements to all vessels in excess of 300 gross tons. You still with me? This may explain why, while the US flag is top in smaller categories of superyachts, once you get over 40 meters, it drops right down the rankings.
So basically, if you're a US owner with a small-ish yacht and a US crew, it makes complete sense to be flagged in the US, and not if you've got something much bigger that you want to do more ambitious stuff with. Maybe not ambitious, wide-ranging.
Yeah.
But it seems like it really works if you're an American owner who's spending a lot of time in America.
That's absolutely right. The second most popular flag, the Cayman Islands, accounts for 10.3% of the overall fleet and wins hands down among the top size categories. So big boats typically carry the Cayman flag. The Cayman Islands has an open registry allowing yachts to hire people from around the world while not having to follow strict employment laws like the ones that exist in the US or Europe. 80% of large yachts are flagged in the British Overseas Territories, commonly known as the Red Ensign Group, in particular the Caymans, Gibraltar and the Isle of Man. Factors influencing that include tradition and history, high standards and adherence to the Large Yacht Commercial Code, the protection of British maritime law, consular services and navy, and commercial confidentiality. Owning companies can be registered in the flag state rather than individually with the person who owns the actual yacht. The third most popular flag is the Maltese flag. It's number three in the overall rankings. It's carried on about 9.2% of all superyachts. This tiny island nation has the biggest registry in Europe. Attractive factors include a long and respected maritime history, full compliance with EU regulations and tax exemptions on commercial yachts. So if you're interested in that kind of subject, in flagging and commercial compliance and all those kinds of things, check out our newly revamped Captains and Crew Focus website, docquark.com, which is a goldmine for this kind of practical information about yacht ownership and operation. Okay, so that's the data story and news for this week. Stick around for Caroline's interview with Barton Meinix from Dutch Studio Vrijpak.
So, Bart and Monix, it's an absolute delight to have you with us today. Before we jump into the world of yacht design, can you tell me, do you own any boats yourselves? And if so, can you tell me a bit about the stories behind them?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, interesting enough, we both own classic boats. I fell in love with classic boats a long, long time ago. and from 1725 foot. Okay, there was one composite boat in between, which we sold about 10 years ago, and then we bought. We saw. I fell in love with it, with just a beautiful 35 steel hull, antique superstructure sailboat. In dreadful shape, and over the years we restored it, brought her back in her former glory, and now we are sailing the Baltic with it, which we love dearly. And as that project was finished, I'm a little bit of a project guy. I convinced my wife it was time for another project, so we bought a 17 foot Chris Craft Deluxe, a project boat out of the US, which was brought to our home in a container. And that's now in my garage, and slowly yet surely restoring it in my in the little free time we have. But I'm dedicated. I will not say desperate, super keen to sail it. But I'm dedicated to finish it for the next season. So Marnix is pushing me because he wants to join for a test drive in this V8 to explore the V8 petrol engine, which is in the back.
How exciting. How about you, Marnix? Have you got something of your own?
Yeah, I think we first should make clarify that there's a whole lot of wood in Barty's garage, which probably was owned one day by the Chriscraft company to make a boat out of it. and he's desperately trying to get it in the right shape. We should share pictures for the website or one thing. but I equally love classic boats, and we're both sailors really. So me and my wife, we have this beautiful classic Cape Dory Typhoon day sailor, which we live on the lake here in the Lake District and north from Amsterdam, and it's just a splendid boat for here. But I actually fell in love with that boat while during a morning jog around the Chesapeake Bay when I was in Annapolis with friends, and I came back and I told my friend, "Oh, I saw this marvelous boat. That's like just a genius, beautiful, beautiful sheer line." And he immediately knew which boat I was talking about, because apparently up north there are plenty there in the United States. And it actually two or three years later brought me and my wife over for a specific holiday, all pre-internet time. You know, we had internet cafes, hunting Craigslists and local internet cafes in Maine to find sellers of this Cape Dory Typhoon with a trailer, of course, because I had to bring it. I had to bring it to a 7-star transport ship to get it to Europe. But we succeeded in the 2-3 weeks we spent up there, and then brought her here. And I love every single minute sailing on her as much as we can, which is not often enough, like anyone owning a boat, I guess. But it's beautiful to be on the water.
Absolutely. So Vrijpak is one of the oldest studios out there, established in 1961, I believe, next to the legendary firm Sparkman and Stevens. And you're the third generation of owners, and you're about to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the studio this year. Can you tell me, how do you look back at the studio, at its heritage, at what it's achieved, at its specialisms, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it was indeed in October 61 that Dick Boone founded Vrijpak. With basically, I think it was his wife who pushed him. The story is that on an afternoon he said to his wife, maybe I should become a yacht designer. Maybe that's something. Then his wife said, maybe, yeah, okay, then you should maybe get on with it, get it going. So he started off basically in the flow as we are now is very innovative, with an innovative drive. Drive for innovation, but also combining design with naval architecture. That was his modus operandi from day one. Yeah, he's still with us for sure. He's now up and now in the office, looking over the shoulders of the team. Truly in his age now, but we love him still. We love dearly that he's still around and happy to be able to celebrate our 60th anniversary. In October with him.
Yeah, and I think to add on that is that I mean, what happened in this studio in 60 years? I mean, it's just incredible, right? We've done the first sailing yacht, which went beyond the 80 degrees latitude, you know, which now seems like a common thing, but in the early 70s it was definitely not. You know, Turmoil was the first yacht to conquer the Northwest Passage at a time where even less was known about it than today. We got this whole range of Dogger's Bank explorer yachts roaming, you know, all the worlds. And then You know, in the modern days, we're doing all of a sudden hydrofoiling, purely solar powered, one design race boat. So I mean, it's just an absolute pleasure designing with this company, and in a way, a humbling experience to creatively direct it to the fourth generation of owners.
Yeah, and with this in our archives of over 7,500 projects, there is indeed a very interesting section of commercial boats. It's not widely known, but we do quite a bit of commercial boats, and so commercial boats in the way of fast patrol boats, ferries, crew transfer boats, rescue boats. So yeah, more or less the what we call the high-end commercial. We love doing that because it's a very interesting segment, because it's all about functionality, about reliability, about low maintenance, because ultimately these commercial boats are tools. They are made to yeah, make money and perform 24/7 in any weather. So there's a lot of interesting aspects which you can take from commercial and implement in yachting. For instance, the slide hull, which we patented it. It was developed in commercial, where we learned that the slide hull is outperforming any hull on efficiency, on space, and on comfort, which is very important on both segments, on both commercial and yachting.
So I understand that the slide hull was developed to get windmill workers to offshore windmills. Is that right? Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah. It was. So the interesting thing we've learned when we got the request at the time is that the windmills, which are all placed in these beautiful windmill farms offshore, are having to be maintained by land-based electricians. And there's a little problem with people doing that, as they're not seafarers. So the minute they step on a boat and it's a bit rough weather in the wintertime, they get seasick, and then it's dangerous to get them actually on the windmill because they're seasick, and everybody of your listeners ever experienced that knows that you're not really in great shape then. So that's dangerous even. And plus you got to take like 20, 30 minutes to get back into active shape before they can start working. So there was a lot of, in a way, human downtime on maintaining these windmills. And they approached us like, isn't there a solution for that? And that's, of course, I mean, that's a dream request to get. Just basically design me a boat where you don't get seasick. And we've indeed ended up with this slide hull, which rides really like a slide. So it really softens, and it's really slow moving boat in a way compared to any other high planing boat. And it works. I've been in north of Denmark myself, you know, and then in the morning the boats line up to bring the workers to the windmills, and everybody lines up to our boat first because they want to drive with our boat to the windmills and don't get seasick. So that's just very very cool.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So, and Anita, we have now about 25 to 30 of 30 yacht projects with the slide hull, and indeed there we see that. The numbers, the parameters we see in commercial, we also see in yachting. And ultimately, that was also validated when we did the slide hull for the Burger Boat Company or for Fairline, because on both projects, it was tank tested. Let's say a conventional hull and the slide hull were both tank tested. And then indeed, it proved that the comfort is about 30% more, and the speed on the same speed range and the fuel economy is about 30% improved. So that's these are our interesting numbers, especially for the yachting, as a slide hull is a hull which has a lot of interior volume, especially in the front, because yeah, indeed on the yacht you want to maximize interior volume, and that's indeed a benefit, an additional benefit which the slide hull brings.
Interesting. So that's a lesson that you've taken from commercial into the yachting world. Into yachting design.
One of the many, yeah.
Yeah. So on that note, I understand that the second 71-meter LNG ferry that you guys designed has been launched recently. Can you tell me about the experience of planning for a vessel like that, with the different needs and tastes of lots of people have to be considered in a project like that? Can you tell me how that kind of intersects with your yacht design work?
Very, very, very much so indeed. It's like I regularly compare it to, they think, when an architect would design a library or a town hall. You know, it's a product, this ferry, which everyone uses. Workers from the island will go back and forward to home. Visitors will have their holidays. There will be dogs, strollers, invalids, everybody. Whole society uses this product and has, therefore, specific needs, requirements, ways to find the WCs, you know, use the restaurant. And the restaurant itself these days has to make money, so there's ways to guide people on also buying the right cups of coffee and soups and fresh bread, etc. And that's very, very interesting. It's an exponentially large sum of what we also do on yachts. And yachts, you also have owner and you have the kids or grandparents. And then you have the crew, of course, the captain, the engineer, the stewardess. So there's already a whole little set of this mini town on a yard, but on a ferry, it just exponentially grows, and you gotta take care of those needs, the workflow, etc. It's very interesting.
Yes, indeed, from a functional aspect, it's very interesting, but also from the design, from the materials you choose, because ultimately the ferry is an object which goes from A to B and back, but the ferry company has a certain budget in mind. But yeah, from a design point, we say, but we don't want to make it a little bit nicer, a little bit more friendlier. So there's an incredible, interesting challenge around the making it still beautiful, but affordable for the ferry company and also easy to maintain. So that was also an extremely, very, very interesting aspect of this design process, where, again, we learned a lot.
Absolutely. And when we spoke before, Marnix, you mentioned the sort of computer modeling that's used in projects like this. Could you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah. So because the flow of people is so large and the boats themselves are on a very tight time schedule, the on and off boarding is very important, not only in the normal situation of getting on and off board because you arrived at your destination, but also in case of emergency and fires and those kind of things, which you all have to take care of course. Safety is extremely important element of our daily work. And so in order to get a better grip on that, indeed, we've approached a football stadium and sports stadium developers, where, because they're already able with artificial intelligence to do crowd simulation of large groups of people and how they will behave within a certain design of a layout and a set parameters. And the interesting fun fact is that because of that reason, the starboard forward stairway is double the dimension of the port side one, because apparently, just from nature, people like to offload on the starboard forward side. And that actually, we would have never imagined or learned that ourselves. And it would have meant that if we would just follow the traditional rules and don't make use of the modern tools, that those stairways would be, you know, symmetrical as you would design them, and there will be a row in front of the starboard well to go down. Yeah.
How interesting. Well, turning to your yachting world, could you tell us a little bit about what's on the drawing boards for you guys?
It's a bit much at the moment. I mean we're blessed with quite some beautiful work. I'm thinking of this 65 meter Bohemian yacht, which we specifically designed for the Bohemian waters as the house of the family for the time they spent there. We're working on this 40 meter Explorer, which is really in the spirit of RH3 and Jasmine, really a beautiful husky ocean-going vessel, while doing 118 foot fast displacement custom yacht for a client. Just launched a motor sailor in Chile, you know, which I mean, that's just a story by itself for a podcast in the future. Straight up to we just signed a contract last week for a 90 meter Explorer, so it's the whole field, at least on my drawing board. But I think Bart's board is even busier.
Yeah, there's always a little bit of competition, but it's a very healthy competition. Now we are also very, very proud that we are that we recently signed a contract for the development of a full range of electrical production motorboats, mainly dedicated for inland waters, which is, I think, a nice example of the electrification which is slowly appearing in our industry. But also developing an 80-foot full custom super architectural styled project for an owner with a burger boat, also doing a really major interior and exterior refit on a 60 meter. Basically, only the bare hull was left after ripping the boat apart. Two boats we're building with MCP in Brazil. Also love working with them. About to commission in 4 weeks the biggest steel aluminum 500 GT yacht with Alia. And nicely on our way with a 60 meter yacht support vessel. But also a project where we are very, very proud of is that we are building the biggest sportfish yacht with Royal Huisman, the 52 meter, aiming for 30 knots for a very dedicated yachtsman is also a project which is for us a dream project, because especially there again the holistic approach underpinning the design with naval architecture and proper engineering is the way to go for such a project.
So you have a massive variety there of different types of yachts. Obviously you're known for explorer yachts, but there's loads of other types of boats in there, including a motor sailor. Could you tell me, if you don't have a sort of signature style of boat, do you have a signature process, a design process that you work with?
I think it's fair to say that. I mean, I think we both have our ideas of beauty and how things should look. But moreover, I think the way we work in the studio, which is again is very owner user orientated, so to make the whole process a very enjoyable and fun experience for our clients, is that we work with these, I would say, like these dynamic design sprints. So we got these weekly updates towards the client, which mean we have two weekly internal little very short 10-15 minute meetings with the whole team, with the naval architect, with the mechanical engineer, the interior exterior designer, and with those very dynamic sprints get a certain energy flow going which rapidly creates a yacht, and it's the most fun thing to do, because at the beginning you don't know what you're ending up with. There's this whole set of requirements and wishes from the clients and everyone which seems to contradict massively, and without a doubt, like writing a new song, you find with the few keys you have to write a whole new song, in our case design a whole new yacht.
Yeah, but this process, we like to focus and implement the human-centered design approach, which is a method which we highly appreciate, because it drives you towards the human aspect. And the human aspect, then for a yacht, it's the owner and his family, to make sure that what you develop, what you design, is meeting their expectations, or basically surpassing their expectations. And it's a process which also eliminates the too strong of an opinion of the designer itself, or a captain or a broker. It allows you to ensure that what you design, what you develop with the team is meeting the owner's demands. And indeed, as also Mark said, fully holistic, underpinned, because we strongly believe that underpinning is the only way to work first time right and to mitigate risk. Because it we believe it's a little bit of a pity to make a beautiful sketch which is not really, really meeting everybody's expectations. So maybe the shipyards are beautifully done, but we have to do it differently, which is a waste of time. And expect from a beautiful design, also this approach allows you to, that the beautiful design is also comfortable. So in a seaway at anchor, you are on this object, which is also from a motion point of view, maximizing your comfort.
So you always have one eye to the technical side of things, is that correct?
Yeah, and these elements contradict, or maybe give a little bit of friction. But as we say, without friction, there's no gloss. So you need to combine this, but also have a little bit of friction now and then. That's good. That's good, a little bit of friction.
So thinking of interesting projects that you guys have been working on in the last couple of years, you launched the New Wave campaign last year, and that addressed sustainability as a design challenge, and was involved with the Ocean Family Foundation and the Save the Seas movie. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
It's during our the last edition indeed of the Free Things Night Out, which we have in November every year in Amsterdam, where we share and have an open innovation debate and share like really active knowledge with anybody who wants to join that evening. It became very apparent that the last time all the 14 subjects were one way or another connected to sustainability. And I think this is actually down to Bart and myself, because we always explain to our clients that we don't view sustainability as some kind of, sacrifice you have to make as a person, you know, that you have to do less because you want to be sustainable, or that we should wait for the politics to get involved, you know, because we can't force anybody to do sustainability as such. We really see it as a design challenge, as our challenge, as us as designers having to do our important part in changing the world ahead. I mean, as such, we choose actively to have our part in it. We think it could be a large part. We're definitely only one of the people here, you know. This involves many, many, many people, and everybody has to, let's say, really collaborate together. But we do feel that designers are specifically set into a situation where they can really actively lead, even, you know, asked or unasked by clients.
The designer has to also from nature has to be creative, has to inspire, has to propose to support a more sustainable approach and a more sustainable product. It's we believe it's the designer who should lead, but ultimately, as Marnik said, it requires all players to work together.
And can you share some actual solutions that you've been thinking about?
Yeah, we like to divide them in two areas. So you have the cutting edge and you have the bleeding edge, where indeed a cutting edge is highly innovative and new, but at least buildable. It has passed prototyping. Yeah, and for an example, yeah, to have a large battery bank in a boat to allow for peak shaving or going through the night without generator. But also, I think, which is quite common now, but we were, I believe, even the inventor of it, is the engine room cooling. So basically allowing for more comfortable engine room and less heat on the and noise on the outer decks. It was bleeding edge, but it's now becoming cutting edge. Is the bio-based batteries. We are working with a startup here close to our studio, which has developed a fully bio-based battery, which is fully biodegradable. It has endless cycles. It can discharge and charge on the same time. But you can also put it on the beach, and then in a couple of years, it's totally vanished. It's fully embraced again by nature because it's based of sand, seaweed, and a cathode, which is just highly highly interesting. And there are a lot of other solutions which are, close to be prototyped and so almost ready to be implemented.
Yeah, I think that shows exactly what Bart's saying. That shows the way we work. So prototyping is an integral part of what we do. And if I look, you know, at a couple of these bleeding edge solutions, which bleeding edge means, you know, you as a client have to be willing to invest in this. You know, this is you'll fail, you'll learn, and then you'll get on board, so to say. You'll fail again, and you got to repeat. But it will bring you further. And a current example of that is that we're working. To particularly energy is a focus point on us for doing this, and we're working on a wind generator to create a wind generator on board. As making energy now is all done by fossil fuel, and you want to replace this fossil fuel in a way, and wind is nearly always there, and that led us to prototyping of a gigantic kite, a 100 square meter kite, which we're flying behind. The mothership, and because it flies an infinite pattern, so it flies a circle 8, so to say, it actually is possible with a winch to generate electricity by pulling and pushing back in the kite, and again, prototyping important part of this. So on board of the rock number one, one of our designs, we now have a very 20 square meter, so a small one between brackets, kite flying and actually learning about that. And end of the summer period, we'll do the same on a full scale. So, yeah, there's really endless things you can do as a designer to lead this sustainability charge. It's actually more easy than you would imagine.
Yeah, so indeed, coming back to what we mentioned before, it's the objective, it's the role, it's the duty of the designer to inspire, to propose, and then ultimately it's for the owner and the team around him to basically select what they want to implement in their project. But and that goes so far indeed from the kite, bio-based batteries, thermal loops, which can be installed in the boat to drastically reduce the need for hot water boilers. hydrogen, which we are now prototyping in our first boat, which was actually quite successful a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, there's just a lot you can do, but you have to know how to what's out there and how to implement and what are the pros and cons, because everything has pros and cons. But it's the objective, it's the duty of the designer to bring it to the table.
And I understand that there is a rumor that you are working on a 100% fossil-free yacht. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, how do you say this? Can't deny nor confirm this. No, you've clearly done your homework. So yes, this is a rumor, and it's been a rumor for two and a half years now with a quite a large international group of mostly external from our industry specialists trying to. Yeah, to solve this puzzle of is it possible to do large, and with large I'm saying like around 70 meter luxury yacht to operate without any single drop of oil on board. And we got approached by the owner 3 years ago now, who was really he made a world trip around shipyards. A lot of people just said no, we can't do that, or at least we don't know how to start or whatever. He kind of got disappointed with that a lot. And by chance, I was working in our Monaco studio, and then I bumped into a friend, and he said, yeah, you guys always think out of the box. You know, can't you talk to him? You know, see what's possible. And yeah, that started off, which now is, I think, 32,000 man hours of research and development. And you have to wait for it a little bit longer, but very soon we'll release details. We'll be able to release details on this build, which will be just completely game-changing in all aspects, not in the least, because the owner does not want to keep it private, ultimately. His knowledge and everything he learned, but wants to give this to whoever wants to use it.
I think especially that last element will be, is for me, a very big contributing element to the industry, because basically I says, you know, I just want to, for sure, I want to prove it can be done, but now then also bring all this information open source, make it available to the industry, and you, please use it, embrace it, because yeah, we have to be more sustainable. And the careful listener will think, oh, okay, no fossil fuel, okay, so it will be hydrogen. No, it's also not hydrogen.
Wow, that's incredibly intriguing.
But more will be revealed.
Okay, well, we look forward to that. As a final question, could you tell me about your plans for the future? So as we mentioned at the beginning, you're celebrating the 60th anniversary of the studio. What are your plans for the future? Do you have any particular ambitions for the business?
It is always a little bit difficult to think for the future, because we're so busy now with all these really cool projects. But sure, there is an ambition, and I think that ultimately the ambition is to further enhance the design process, the enjoyment of the design process with our clients, and to push and implement cutting edge and bleeding edge innovations.
Yeah, I think visualization is already a big part of what we do today. Already 2014, we empowered virtual reality, which now every boat goes rigidly to virtual reality. We're sending animation videos of boats which don't exist to clients. Where clients are logging in California on our server. We both are running through the boat in virtual reality. I think the future is so. We don't know what it has in holds for us, but we'll embrace it with two hands and continue making beautiful boats which sail the world and make you feel at home.
Fantastic. Well, Bart and Monix, thank you so much for speaking to me, and we do look forward to hearing more about that exciting fossil-free project.
You'll be the first.
Agreed.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.